welcome to Cooler Than Homework, a Disney Channel original movie podcast. I'm Nicole Sweeney, and not only did I have an imaginary friend with a ridiculous name, it was Brixa, I also went that extra step and had an imaginary frenemy who was my imaginary best friend's other friend who I kept around because Brixa liked her. So that's who I was as a child.
Did your frenemy have a name?
Amra.
All right. Well, I'm Matthew Gatos. And when I was little, I had an imaginary friend named George. And I don't personally remember George, but apparently my mom told me that I had an imaginary friend named George who I was always concerned about people sitting on because he was sitting in certain chairs in the room. And I had to be like, no, you can't sit there. George is sitting there.
My name is Marines, and I was a very vivid daydreamer. Like I was a very spacey child, but never to the extent of having an imaginary friend. So sorry, guys, I'm the boring one this week.
And I'm Sari Riley. And when I was younger, I played too much of the N64 game, Hey You Pikachu, where you yelled into a microphone and had Pikachu do things. And so when we were moving across the country from Indianapolis to Washington, I thought I heard Pikachu talking to me all the time. I guess that's imaginary friend.
Matt's addition about George reminded me that one of Brixa's qualities was that she could be any age she wanted to be, which Ooh. I would rely on when it was my bedtime, because then I had an adult to stay up with me. You see, Brixa felt like being 20 years old when it was time for me to go to bed. So then I didn't need to go to bed.
That's very good.
Amazing.
So I also want to point out that this is the second week in a row that we've introduced ourselves with a story in which I am the most extra, but I did not pick either of these intro themes. This was not my choice. I just happened to be a lot as a child and also now. But anyway, this week we are talking about Don't Look Under the Bed, and Mari is gonna tell us what happened.
Well, I can tell you first off what didn't happen, and that was most of what Sari guessed last week. But one little detail that she got surprisingly right. I don't know. You said something kind of about like personalized demons. And that sounds like a boogeyman to me.
At least this story's version of the boogeyman.
For sure. Yeah. So anybody keeping track at home, feel free to give Sari a point for that one. In this movie, we start and strange things have been happening in the town of Middleburg. We watch as clocks all over town move forward at the McCausland house. Mom, dad, the two brothers, and our protagonist, Francis, all wake up and are super sleepy and cranky until the dad confirms that it is indeed 4 o'clock in the morning and not 7 o'clock. When it is actually time to go to school, we learn that Frances has skipped a grade and is going to high school early. As she walks with her best friend Joanne, they see that there are dogs on roofs all over town, and Frances also spots a boy staring at her with interest, but when she tries to point him out to Joanne, the boy disappears. Weird things continue to happen, and they all point back to Frances. So eggs go missing at her house, and somebody eggs the teacher's car. Jello goes missing at home, and somebody turns the school swimming pool into Jello. Spray-painted bees appear on every locker at school, except the bee is spray-painted inside of Frances's locker. When Frances sees the mysterious boy again, he introduces himself as Larry Houdini, an imaginary friend. It takes her a long time to accept this, even though no one else can see Larry, and she embarrasses herself a lot trying to get people to see him, and I hated it. It was so rough to watch for somebody like me who has chronic secondhand embarrassment. More bad things happen. The whole town has a blackout, for instance, and the McCausland house is lit up in Christmas lights, and someone outs Joanne's crush. Her parents start to get really worried about all of this. The press gets involved and the school gets involved. We also learn that Francis' little brother had cancer, but their older brother donated bone marrow, and now Darwin is in recovery. Larry explains that Frances is being framed by the boogeyman. She follows Larry to the library to check out a book on boogeymen, which explains how to build something called a tetrafuse, which will age the boogeyman into being harmless. It also has a recipe for boogie goo, which is a disgusting combination of ingredients that will attract the boogeyman. Meanwhile, something is not right with Larry. His eyes are sensitive to light, his nails grow longer, and he finds the yucky boogie goo yummy. All of this scares Francis. All of this scares Francis, who looks up in the boogie book where boogeymen come from, and it turns out boogeymen are made when children stop believing in their imaginary friends too soon. Larry used to be Darwin's imaginary friend, but Francis convinced Darwin to stop believing once he got sick. Darwin accidentally steps in some boogie goo, which attracts the boogeyman, who kidnaps Darwin and takes him under the bed to the boogie world. Francis and Larry follow and try to save Darwin and defeat the boogeyman, but the tetrafuse doesn't work. And also, Larry has finished his transformation into a boogeyman. Faced with two boogeymen, Francis tells Darwin that she was wrong and his imaginary friend is in fact real. Darwin starts believing again, and Larry comes back. Francis also realizes that the original boogeyman who has been framing her this whole time is her own imaginary friend, Zoe. Francis stopped believing in her when Darwin got sick, and she decided it was time to be a grown-up. Francis grabs the boogeyman's hand, and it turns him back into Zoe. Back out from under the bed, Francis's parents come with the news that the same things that have been happening in Middleburg are happening elsewhere. They apologize for not believing in her. Zoe and Larry decide to head out to that other town that now has a boogeyman and help there. They also break the news that Francis won't be able to see them anymore. Francis is upset about this, but then Larry gives her a kiss and she's like, wow, you are right. I'm grown. Larry tells her, though, that you can grow up, but you don't have to get old. That night, Darwin is scared, probably because he got straight up kidnapped by a boogeyman. And like, sure, I would be afraid too. So Francis lets him sleep with her. Larry and Zoe smile and watch before disappearing. The end.
Matt, what is this cast up to now? I have no idea, genuinely. So I'm excited for you to tell me.
I know one person.
What? Ooh,
yes, that's what I was hoping for.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah. I watched Groundhog's Day 7 times in a row. And I will recognize every single person in that movie.
So yes, speaking of the one and only person Sari will possibly know in this movie, and probably the most interesting person on my list, so to be fair, I'm starting high and going downhill. Stephen Tobolowsky, who plays the dad in this, he is a writer, a podcaster. He has a podcast called The Tobolowsky Files, and an actor in just about everything. I actually had in my notes that I wanted to check and see if Sari recognized this man.
Ned Ryerson.
Bing.
I know.
Got it.
Can you, Sari, I feel like you should also explain why you watched Groundhog's Day 7 times in a row.
Oh, yes. Our local community movie theater, The Roxy, on Groundhog's Day did a challenge where if you sit and watch the movie Groundhog's Day, I believe 7 times in a row, you get free movies for a year and free popcorn for a year. And so I thought, what else am I going to do on a Saturday? And so I sat in there and watched it 7 times in a row with like 13-minute food breaks, whatever it is. Like the movie is almost 2 hours. And so whatever small bit of time you had in between viewings was the only like bathroom food break you were allowed.
So that is why our very own Technotar under a rock, Sari Riley, is like, wait, no, yes, this is it.
He is in Groundhog Day. He is also in Spaceballs, The Goldbergs, Heroes, Glee, Deadwood, One Day at a Time. This man has 270 acting credits.
Whoa.
Yeah. And a fun little tidbit I found out about him that is just completely wild and isn't necessarily a where are they now situation, but had to be shared. He has a form of ESP he calls hearing tones. And while working with David Byrne on his film True Stories, he told Byrne about this gift, who was inspired to write the song Radiohead about him. And then later on, the band Radiohead took its name from that song. So Stephen Tobolowsky is the reason that Radiohead is called Radiohead.
What the hell?
man can't be a real person.
That story also just had so many moving parts. I felt like the middle-aged lady doing math, like listening, like... There were so many things going on there. That was wild.
Yeah. I feel like I know a lot about Stephen Tobolowsky because he's just been a person through like out my childhood in almost everything I watch. So that to learn something completely new and completely wild about him was great. So yeah, continuing with the cast, somebody who for some reason at one point disappears in this movie, Rudy Sade, I'm going to pronounce that way, plays Joe, the best friend, I guess, in this film. And she acted in a few more things after this, but seems to have stopped about 10 years ago. She was in Big Mama's House and a couple other things, and doesn't have much of an online presence, except I found some tweets from a few years ago where she was very, like, sweetly tweeting at the singer from Incubus, telling him how much she loved him. Next up on the list, we have Steve Valentine, who played the boogeyman in this. He has gone on to do a lot of minor roles in things like Spider-Man 3, NCIS, Psych, The Big Bang Theory, and most recently is the voice of Commander Heist, who's a villain on a show called Mickey and the Roadster Racers, which is probably on Disney Plus. I don't know. If you have kids, yes, they've probably seen it. Next up, we have Robin Riker, who plays Francis's mom, who we've talked about before on this show. So I don't have much of an update because she was also Brink's mom. But Robin Riker plays Catherine Madison in an episode of Buffy called Witch, which I think we talked about last time. And she's also just been in a lot of soap operas. Next up, we have the star of the show, Francis. I guess that's arguable star of the show, Francis, played by Erin Chambers. She's gone on to do so many episodes of not only General Hospital, but also Days of Our Lives, The Young and the Restless. And she was in the movie Alvin and the Chipmunks.
That's who?
I didn't see that movie, so I can't. Place oh,
okay. I've seen that one too, but she was just not, I didn't watch it seven times, so I don't remember anyone in it.
According to IMDb, she was press coordinator.
Oh.
So probably no. Not.
It's like if she was the main woman, like the love interest in it, maybe I would. I'm the fool not recognizing her, but press coordinator. No.
Nicole, she was also Amelia de Longpre in Veronica Mars.
Oh, yes. I knew her dang face and I couldn't place her. Yes. Okay. The whole world makes sense to me now. I was waiting. I was like, I'm not going to like look her up. I'm going to let Matt do the thing and like that will make it make sense, but this was not something that would stand out to Matt.
No,
it was really unsettling the entire time I was watching it that I was like, I know this face.
I also found out she was 20 in this film when she's playing 14-year-old Francis Bacon McCausland.
What?
Yeah, 20 years old.
I'm not surprised that she's not 14, but it is wild to me that she's 20.
Especially playing like a middle schooler who has been like bumped ahead into high school. Like it's weird that they would cast an even older person to play that person. Last, but certainly not least, in our Where Are They Now segment, we have Ty Hodges, who played Larry Houdini. First of all, I'm going to send a visual aid link over to my fellow podcasters here just so they can see how Ty's holding up.
Wow.
Just good. A quiet mm-hmm. Yeah, this man is insanely ripped. This man is just ripped to the nines. I don't know like what his diet is, but I want it. I'm gonna steal it, whatever it is, whatever workout he's doing. Looking great, Ty Hodges.
Can I get on the Matt wants to get on the imaginary friend workout plan.
Yeah, whatever he's doing. Good job, dude. Apparently, since being Larry Houdini in this film, he also went on to be in Even Stevens. I don't know if anyone else watched Even Stevens. I was not really watching that when it was out, but I don't know if you recognized him from that.
Sorry, I was still looking at this picture.
That's fair. It's on his Instagram. For those that are interested, just find Ty Hodges on Instagram. It's the Ty Hodges, and it's one of his more recent photos. So you too can see the...
It'll be in the show notes as well.
Yeah, there you go.
Yes, I watched Even Stevens pretty regularly. I feel like I don't recognize him in my head. But if I saw an episode of Even Stevens again, I'd be like, oh, that kid.
That is exactly how I felt too. he was another one who, while I was watching it, I was like, he's vaguely familiar, but in that way that the Disney Channel sort of used its actors across a lot of different things. So I just sort of assumed anybody that looked familiar, like probably they were in something else on the Disney Channel, couldn't necessarily place what, but I just stopped and looked him up. He was Ren's rival, like the other like smart. Sure. Yes,
yes,
right?
Yes,
like,
yes. Okay, I just saw him. Yes.
I read the character description and I was like, okay, yes, that guy.
Yeah. Yeah, he's gone on to, he had a food truck apparently with his family called Drippin' Chicken, which is great.
Sure. The food industry does appear to be a really like popular choice for former DCOM stars. And I love it.
Yeah, it's like soap operas and the food industry.
We should go on a big road trip. Like, okay, if we ever get to a place where we can do like a tour.
It's the project of the episode.
This will never happen. But yeah. Yes, we're going to stop and eat at all the restaurants. It'll be great.
I'm on board. Speaking of food and also Even Stevens, he was recently on Christy Carlson Romano's Throwback Kitchen Cooking Show that she has on YouTube. So you can go watch those two be charming together, and they make jerk chicken together. So, yeah.
His Instagram profile has hashtag 305, which I'm assuming means he's in Miami. So I can find him and ask him about his food and workout regimen for you, Matt.
This is just for Matt, like, yes, like for Matt.
Clearly,
yeah.
I'm a good friend.
Don't look under the bed. Nostalgia check. Do you remember watching this movie as a kid?
No.
I do. And I was so worried last week about the experience of revisiting it because it was totally my jam and I'm still really nervous. But yes, this was my jam.
I have no recollection whatsoever of watching this movie as a kid.
And nope, no recollection at all.
You know, we keep hoping like maybe this week it'll be time. This will be the one. Sari's like, oh yeah, I watched that DCOM all the time. It was my favorite movie.
Yeah. I'm kind of afraid that I'll see a movie and I'll be like, this actually seems kind of familiar. But it will take me until like halfway through to realize that I've watched it before.
So this is a new experience for most of us, but did you like this movie? Mari, did it hold up? How do you feel?
I don't know. I feel like I can totally see why this was my jam growing up. I mean, I think part of it too was it was like on heavy repeat when it came out and I watched it every time, but also it was a little slower paced, I think. And there were times where I found myself tuning out. And I don't know if that was partially because this was like very familiar to me, but also when I was trying to do the like summary of the plot, there was a lot in the middle where I was like, out of K, man, like weird stuff is happening. So I feel like there is some muddiness in the plot. I really didn't want to go first because I wanted to hear what you guys had to say. There are some feels for sure, but Erin Chambers, I think, didn't always do a good job of like selling her more emotional scenes. Mm-hmm. But it's like sibling feels and it's like grief. And it's, I mean, you even have like cancer thrown in there. So there were a lot of times that I was like, yeah, man, that still gets me in the heart. So I don't think that it's my favorite. It doesn't hold out that well compared to some of the other ones that we saw. But yeah, it was good. It was no Can of Worms.
That's going to be the bottom bar, I think, for a long time of like, yeah, at least it's not as bad as Can of Worms.
My bottom is still Genius. I committed to it. I can't change my list.
I also like Genius is my second to the bottom. So I agree that those two deserve each other down at the bottom of the list. But that being said, Don't Look Under the Bed, I really enjoyed actually. So I loved the slow pace of it, actually. I think that was one of my favorite things about it, was that there wasn't a lot going on and it didn't try to like throw you into this super heavy concept in the first 5 minutes and just throw a bunch of information at you. It kind of let things develop. And for a while, yeah, I think there are parts where it slows down enough that you could easily be looking away or forget what happened in sections because not a lot happens. Larry Houdini has to be very charming and carry this movie because no one else is doing anything. So I think that he does a really good job of that and makes me interested enough in his character and in the movie to keep me enjoying it. So I think it kind of lands somewhere in the middle for me and on the DCOM list, but I still can't think of something that I outright disliked about this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had similar feelings where it was just kind of middling for me. And Larry Houdini, like you said, Matt, had the task of carrying this whole movie, and I thought he did a pretty good job. Like, the costumes were entertaining. He was constantly very high energy and had a lot of, I don't know, physical comedy and sight gags, and was just like a goofy kid. The other kid actors did pretty good pretending he didn't exist and things like that too. And I really liked going under the bed at the end. I can guarantee that I would have wished as a kid that I could shrink down and go and explore the spooky underbed where everything becomes giant. Because, yeah. I don't know, that was the kind of stuff that I was into, and it would have been fun and weird.
The boogie world was very, very cool.
Mm-hmm. That whole boogie world thing was super cool. I agree with everything that's been said so far about the character of Larry Houdini. I think that he was super fun, and just the whole end of the movie I thought was really good. This one got off to kind of a rough start for me, both because of all of the camera movements. I was just like, please stop.
Yeah.
Please just be still. So that was like a little rough for me. And also, we're going to talk about this later, but the central plot is one in which people are not believing the protagonist about something that's going on. And like, it has to be that way, and it's for the point of the story, but that is a thing that stresses me out so much. Like, I hate it. I hate the trope of people not believing the main character about something that we, the audience, know to be true.
Especially when there's so many moments in this film where we know very clearly, like, what she could say to get out of this, or
yes.
Just we know that other characters are experiencing similar things to her. And so everyone is blind to the outside world and is only focused on her being the one clearly to blame and won't listen to reason. But also, no one else is really giving the good reasons that we know there are to give.
I started thinking about this as, like, you know, it's billed as horror. You know, Disney Channel has had like two horror films in their original movie lineup. And so it's interesting to me. Obviously, it's got like the boogeyman and the monster, but also from the perspective of what would really scare you as like a 13 or 14 year old, the idea that all of this was happening and that you were being set up and that you could see things that other people couldn't see. And then everybody starts questioning her, and not only her, but her sanity. Like, all of that is like undercover scary. And I think like maybe says more about who I am still as an adult than it says about like what the movie did good. But watching it still, I was like uncomfortable. I was like, I don't want this. I want somebody to believe her. So it was still, I guess, effective in that way. But yeah, the things that it did that were like about the boogeyman and this whole idea that if you had an imaginary friend and you stopped believing in that person, then they would become a boogeyman, like, that, I thought that was clever. Like, there were a lot of like those lines of it that I was still like, yeah, man, I see why I watched the crap out of this.
Yeah, totally. I think I bring up the not liking that trope mostly to say why I got off to a rough start with this movie. So like, for the first, I don't know, half hour, I was like, I am not sure about any of this. I'm not sure how I feel about this fucking camera that won't stop moving and all these adults who are accusing this girl of doing this thing that she clearly didn't do. And for sure, this was, you know, the stuff of my young nightmare. So if I had seen this, like, maybe I did see this movie and I blocked it out because it's traumatic. That first, you know, like half hour, I was like, this is not the experience that I am looking for in a Disney Channel original movie. If I want to be this upset, I will watch not this. But I think that, yes, ultimately, the ideas in the movie are really, really interesting to me, because there's a lot of like heavy, high level stuff going on in what is fundamentally, to its core, a children's story. And so I think that is super interesting, just like the way in which she is what is her name? I want to call her Amelia DeLongpre now.
Frances.
Frances. The way in which Frances is dealing with her sort of guilt and grief combined about her brother and, you know, just the idea of like an imaginary friend going through a like painful growing up sort of phase too, like at all of the layers of that kind of stuff, I thought were really, really interesting and thoughtful. And it is the kind of thing that I find super interesting and kind of wish, like, I want to see it in a more complex story. Like, I'm glad it exists in a space like this that is well and truly for children, but there's also a part of me that's like, okay, but can I get a more fleshed out version of this for adult me?
You basically said everything so beautifully that has now reinvigorated my appreciation for this movie, and I'm gonna be negative because I have to justify why it's halfway down my list.
I mean, you could move it, but
I could move it, but no,
I guess you could also ruin it.
They're very petty grievances. I think in the same way the camera angles at the beginning were jarring to you, Nicole, the same shot of the dolls turning their heads toward the camera that they used maybe like, it was probably like three, but it felt like 50 times throughout the movie. I thought it worked for me, and it probably would have worked for me as a kid, but as an adult watching it, that pulled me out of it a little bit. Like the...
Sari, did you never have to sleep in a room full of dolls? Because
no.
Let me tell you, if you had that experience as a child, it still affects me some type of way as an adult.
Clearly, I'm not the target demo for this movie. Yes. I have never slept in a room with dolls. Creepy, but I think the emphasis on the like environmental horror of it, so the ways in which the boogeyman wasn't just causing pranks, but like, I don't know, all I remember is the dolls and like the crow flapped in the back of the classroom or something like that. But it was okay. Not particularly for me. And then when Larry kissed her, that
oh yes,
unnecessary.
No, I agree. Yes,
unnecessary plot point. I started thinking about how it was weird that her brother's imaginary friend was kissing her, and then I was like, nope, can't.
I also super felt that way, and I messaged Mari as soon as I got to it. So part of me feels like you added that line to your plot synopsis mostly like to preempt the line about her being like, I am grown now or whatever, solely to preempt this point, which I totally forgot about. But I am 100% with Sari. That was fucking weird.
What did you send me?
I basically just something along the lines of like, that was really weird. Like, I was with the movie. I was straight up crying. I mean, I had been crying before I started watching this movie. So like, I was in a state. I was primed to be emotional. But like, something at the in that ending sequence had me in tears. And I like messaged you about how I was in tears. And then 5 seconds later, the imaginary friend kisses her, and I was like, wait, I'm sorry, what?
Interesting side note about that kiss. It turned out that when Ty Hodges was auditioning for this, he tells this story on the Throwback Kitchen video. He said he went into audition, and like everyone else who was sitting in the audition room was like the Eric Von Dettens of the world. Huh. Like, they did not write the role to be played by a person of color, and they were planning on just like casting the generic DCOM blonde hair, blue eye kid. And so Disney Channel was unsure about casting him because of the kiss scene, especially because they apparently had concerns about their Southern affiliates being unhappy with the on-screen kiss.
Jesus Christ.
Yep.
Yes, in 1999. Yeah.
You kissed the heck out of her, Ty Hodges.
All right. Yeah.
Now, yeah. I'm in favor of the kiss. Yeah.
We have to support this fucking kiss. Uh-huh.
I didn't mean that as like a way to try and sway you, because I also agree that it's really weird that the imaginary friend kisses, because I had actually read that fact in the trivia before watching this. I assumed that this would like naturally lead to a romantic moment where they would kiss, and then going through the movie, I'm like, huh, they don't seem to be really like falling for each other. And so then when he does kiss her, it is It is weird.
They're not falling for each other. I'm not defending this, but listen.
Aren't you though?
When she first sees him, like it's this like very aw shucks kind of thing where she pulls her friend aside and she's like, that guy is looking at me. And then there's another moment where they're interacting or whatever. And she like, you can see her, like she puts her hair behind her ear and she's like doing it in a very like blushy kind of like, yeah, I can see you kind of way. So for her, it was always like, ooh, cute boy. And then things kind of spiral out of control. Mm. But also there's also, you know, like she shared with him a lot about like grieving for her brother. And like, he was a friend. I don't know. There was an emotion there, I guess. I think that what makes the kiss weird is that it wasn't like, goodbye, Francis, I'll miss you, kiss. It was like, she didn't want to say goodbye. And she was like, he was like, I got this. And he kissed her and she was like, okay, bye. I don't know. That dynamic was weird. But the fact that these two people who went through a lot at the end, you know, it's about like growing up. So I sent So I sent Nicole a message and I was like, I can't wait to talk about some of the undercover weird like messages or like politics of this movie. And one was the fact that like at the end, she's like, ah, my sexual awakening is here. No more imaginary friends. Weird.
Now that you've said that, and I think this is maybe brewing in the back of my head, but until you explained her like ongoing crush so wonderfully, I think I wouldn't have a problem with it if she kissed him instead.
Yes.
If it was like, that was the culmination of like, she had had a crush on him this whole time. And then he was like, whoa, didn't expect that. Cause he's a supernatural being of whatever.
Okay. But counterpoint, if like his whole thing is, I'm the imaginary friend and I'm like, I'm your youth, right? But this moment of the imaginary friends leaving her and like literally saying, you know, bye forever, you will never see us again, we will only exist in your memories. Part of what Mari is getting at, like that is meant to be a moment of like, see, you are grown now. You can move from,
you're a woman now.
Your interests are elsewhere, right? Like,
yes, your interests are elsewhere. I will demonstrate to you now.
Me, a handsome man who lives only in your imagination. This shall happen to you a lot.
Yeah, oh wow,
that's gonna be an awkward first kiss story. Wait, are we getting into like some weird like Edward Bella territory? Like, how old is his character supposed to be?
Oh god.
Millennia, honestly.
He just keeps going from one child to another, I think.
Yes.
Maybe, I don't know. Mm-hmm.
I don't like it. Next.
So the other thing that I was like, kind of like, this is weird watching as an adult, but then I came back around, like I convinced myself that there were a lot of things like this, like where do the imaginary friends come from and how do they exist? And like, they went to the library and there was magically a book there about boogeymen and there's a guy who talks to him in his head. And there were all things that I was like, what? But then I was like, you know, just accept it. It's a story about imaginary friends and like boogeymen. And the fact is that the point of the story is like, don't grow up too soon. Just like have fun and be carefree. And, you know, right. In a lot of ways, the movie is almost like forcing that upon you too. And I am an adult. So I was like, no. But looking at it for the intended audience, I can see how it would have been like fun.
Every time you are thinking to yourself, well, this doesn't make sense, the movie's like, fuck you. This isn't for you. This week's group discussion topic is some of our least favorite tropes. I mentioned previously that sort of this idea of stories where people do not believe the main character about something is a big one for me. And it's interesting too, because I actually can think of a couple of examples of stories that use it really well. One of my favorite Buffy episodes is Normal Again. The premise of the episode is basically that Buffy is institutionalized and she believes that the entire, however many of seasons of the show up to that point, I think this was in season 5, which had a lot of like heavy sort of mental health related themes and stuff built into it, but that she is supposed to have basically had like a mental breakdown and that is the cause of all of the story leading up to that point. Like the reveal is that she is a demonic sort of force has tricked her into this position. I think that's what it is. I actually forget how or why this happened, but the episode has its flaws, but like the actual fundamental concept of Buffy believing firmly in this thing that we, the audience, know to be true because we've, you know, watched all those five seasons play out while nobody is believing her. Like, that idea was really, really cool and interesting of a thing for a show about sort of supernatural stuff to be tackling. And like, I think it was like cool and smart of them to do. But also it's just like really painful for me to watch. And it was only in getting ready to have this conversation that I started to kind of think about why this is something that upsets me so much. And I think some of it is something that Mari said earlier about the fact that it is often situated in children's media. So this is like a very particular kind of thing for kids, especially, you know, to have the idea of not being believed is very directly tied up in a sense of powerlessness for children. And so like those two things going hand in hand just becomes really stressful and unpleasant for me as a viewing or reading experience. And then it's also just like, you know, in a bigger, broader sense, culturally, like that is also true more broadly, that like people not believing you when you are going through something is directly equated to a kind of powerlessness that like, I don't think that media needs to be escapist, but it is a thing that I often am like, I don't know that I want to have this experience. I don't know that I want to choose to have the experience of like putting myself in the position of that kind of powerlessness. So I don't know, for all of those reasons, this sort of trope and phenomenon of people not believing the main character is definitely one of my least favorite tropes, even though it is something that I think can be used very effectively in the right story.
Yeah, I feel the same way about that trope. Like, I do, I am not a fan of it typically. And I think that stems from one of my greatest fears is being misunderstood or not being like, or not really being, I don't know, as I stammer through my words. That's hilarious.
It's this
exact moment, yeah. Right now.
Yes, this is my greatest fear. Realize. But no, I also hate that trope, I think, because it stems largely from one of my greatest fears of being misunderstood. And I am someone who often will like over talk or over explain things because I am afraid of that person walking away from a conversation and thinking that I didn't make myself clear to them. And so I like when I see it to the extreme level of people like downright not believing the truth when you tell it to them, I start to stress out myself. Mm-hmm. But my trope that I hate, I guess, is a strong word maybe for this, but I definitely it's when it happens, it's one of those things that irks me, and I kind of, it ruins rewatches of something for me, and it's the contrived stupidity trope, which is sort of when a character who has not in the past been dumb is suddenly made to be dumber because the writers couldn't think of anything else to complicate the plot, I guess. Mm. And one example of this is kind of an easy one to point at, but on The Simpsons, over the 30 seasons they've had, Homer is a character who has been downright like 3-year-old intelligence and doesn't know how to like operate a car. And then in other episodes, he is seen to like be a normal functioning adult human being kind of thing. And it's just, it's the way they play with that character is kind of like, okay, do we need Homer to be dumb this episode? Sure. Cool. He's dumb now.
That kind of thing is definitely much more common in serialized storytelling where like they have to sort of constantly invent new kind of plots and stuff. And so like for 30 years, there's a point at which you're like, well, I don't know, man, this plot line only works if this character isn't smart enough to notice things that in previous circumstances they would have been smart enough to notice. I think it kind of depends on the type of story that you're telling, whether or not you can get away with that sort of things, like whether or not The Simpsons can do this thing that is annoying and then like carry on versus a story that relies on that is more like inherently intricate, there's a point at which as a viewer, you're like, oh, you just need to stop. You just need to end this story. You need to be done trying to tell this story, because at this point, you are no longer keeping your characters consistent, because it's not possible for you to keep coming up with new stories for these characters that, you know, that make sense for them all to still be together and be having these kinds of experiences.
Yep, which leads me to my prime example that I wanted to bring up with this trope that is a more recent one that it's not a heavy spoiler, I promise you, but it's in Toy Story 4. So if you haven't seen Toy Story 4, it's a little bit of a spoiler, but it's more of like how a character behaves in Toy Story 4 rather than what actually happens. But in Toy Story 4, for some reason, Buzz Lightyear is extremely dumb and has seemed to have forgotten all the lessons he learned in the previous movies, and especially since by this point he's been around and been a toy in this world for like 20 years, we've seen him do a lot of fun adventures with his friends. And suddenly in this, the idea of someone having an inner voice or a conscience, he starts to believe is actually a voice that talks to you through your push button, and he has to do whatever the push button says. And I'm like, what, what? This character has never been this dumb since like when he was first opened in the box in Toy Story 1. And now you need him to be dumb for your movie, so you've completely changed the character.
Yeah, it's like it's a form of character regression without actually exploring what it means for that character to it's fine that to have a character like backslide and you know, unlearn lessons. Like, that is totally a thing that happens. We did an episode on Emma, which is my favorite Jane Austen novel, and like one of my favorite things about Emma, part of why I love her as a character, is because she keeps insisting that she's going to learn her lesson and then she doesn't. Like, she keeps making the same mistakes. Yeah. Like, no, I'm gonna be better now, but then like, you know, she messes up, and like it takes her a few tries to like really get it right, which is incredibly human. Like, that's a very normal and human thing to do. But it like that only works if you're actually exploring that, right? Like, that is baked into the premise of the book. Like, part of what is going on in this book is this story about this young woman, you know, continually messing up until she finally gets it right, as opposed to just suddenly deciding that in order to move our plot along, we need to, you know, move this character backwards a ton, but we're not actually going to explore that character regressing in any way.
And no one acknowledges it or realizes it really. And part of that is because I think, and this is what I love Toy Story 4 and a lot of things they do, but one of the things that makes it hard as a rewatch for me is that a ton of these characters who have been around for all four movies are stripped of most of their personality and are given like nothing to do. So the ways you would expect them to react, Buzz acting like this or other characters doing other things, they don't really do because they don't have much personality. And so it just kind of is a similar thing of like, maybe you should have stopped at three. Because maybe you didn't have a story that you thought you had, especially because they give like Woody this very deep emotional story. And so they had a good idea for one character and then go, oh, right, we have all these other people that need to come along.
I will say the one time I don't mind, I guess, dumbing down a character is if it's in like an exaggerated supervillain character and in certain kinds of stories. And this is probably coming from like watching cartoons a lot, reading comics a lot, superhero stories. On the one hand, I think in order to have a world ending or a world threatening crisis, like, you have to exaggerate in some ways. But the other thing is that usually these really big, really evil forces, like the big bads, are usually written like that in the first place. And then they sort of bend their character to meet whatever the heroes are doing at any given time, which is different than what you're describing about like the character was one way and now it is a different thing because of what we need. This is like, this character was always just like a generic force of evil, and this evil is changing forms because we need the main hero to be pressured in these ways. I don't have any specific examples because I'm tired.
But you are, what you're talking about though is inherently different, because the examples that Matt gave that bothered him are all examples of main characters.
Or yes,
they're both examples of like main characters. And like, part of your point is that it's the villain. It is essentially like a foil character. It is a character who fundamentally exists to serve the main character in some sort of way or another, so it is less bothersome.
Mm-hmm. Once when Matt said his trope, like, I felt it deeply, like, this is something definitely that I had experienced in media. I'm having, like, a hard time pinpointing one, except for, like, the example that came to my head. And it's also not exactly right, but I'm just going to share it with the people. The first thing that I thought of was Anastasia Steele in 50 Shades of Grey. But only because, like, half the time she was, like, a super genius and she got, like, an amazing job and she's the smartest person ever. And then the other half of the time she's like, I don't have an email. And right, you're like, I don't know.
That's what I was just about to say, too. What is email? And she's, like, a 22-year-old college student. Like, what? And
it's because she had to be, like, stupid enough that she would put herself in the situation, not to victim blame, because nobody invites themselves to get almost murdered, which is essentially what I felt like was going on there. But, like, she had to be naive enough, I guess, to get herself into certain situations, but then, like, also the, like, smartest, prettiest human being. So anyway, that was my example. A trope that I really hate is enemies to lovers. I feel like also that this is a trope that generally what happens, I think, in stories is that you get kind of enemies to lovers baited, where more the story, like, puts the sexual tension there. And there's a lot of times that the couple maybe doesn't even end up together. And I'm fine with Hate to Love. Pride and Prejudice is one of my favorite stories of all time. And it's not full blown hate, I would say, but it's like, you know, misunderstanding, they don't get along, and they proceed.
He is the last man on earth that she would ever be prevailed upon to marry, Mari.
Oh, yeah.
Come on now.
So, okay, Hate to Love is great. Fine. We can do that in certain situations. It's the enemies to lovers. Like, if Mr. Darcy had tried to murder Lizzie, like, maybe that's a different story. Yeah, so that entire idea of, like, I want to kill you, but then somehow it ends up being, like, no, but that means I love you. Twilight is a great example of that. Wants to drink her blood, can't help but, like, want to murder her every time he sniffs her, and then all of a sudden they're in love. Hate it. Don't want to do it. I don't want to consume those stories.
And it seems like everyone that you follow on social media loves
all of my friends love enemies to lovers because it's so quote unquote complex. Fuck that. No.
We'll see if we have to have a conversation about that in a few weeks after Star Wars Rise of Skywalker comes out.
That's why this is really coming from my deep hatred of even the possibility of Reylo happening. And you know what? Even if it doesn't happen, I've had to be put up with Reylo for so long on my timeline and in fan communities. I'm so upset.
Listen, you've suffered on the online. The trope that I could think of, and I wanted to keep it simple, was also something where I see it and I'm like, fuck that, I hate it, is when Asian women in movies or TV are given a streak of colored hair to stand out. Big Hero 6, Glee, Scott Pilgrim, always like a blue streak, a purple streak, a pink streak, something to show that they're not like other girls. It's like the modern version of I'm not like other girls, but it's specifically like, oh, I'm Asian, but I'm cool. I don't have just black hair. I have a streak. And I say this as someone with dyed hair, but it's just, it's like bonkers to me. I saw people had, like, put together a montage of this, and it's always like one streak of very long hair, short hair. That's a weird color.
Yeah. Pacific Rim is another one.
I hate it. It's like, write your characters to be different. Write your characters to encompass a range of emotions and personalities and everything. But if you, like, just don't make your Asian female leads have one streak of color in their hair. You can be more creative than
whatever
that.
Whatever you do.
Yeah.
Or Sari is coming for you.
Yeah, I'll fight you.
And now it is time to discuss the lessons that we learned from Don't Look Under the Bed.
I learned that, mostly based on this conversation we've been having, that it's okay to have imaginary friends, but you don't need to kiss them.
That's really funny. And I swear that this is my note for my lesson. My lesson that I learned is that kissing is better than imaginary friends.
My lesson is fingernails can be deadly, so remember to keep them trimmed.
And the lesson that I learned is a direct quote from the movie. Just because you're getting older doesn't mean you have to get old.
Deep.
And now, to close out this episode, it is time for Sari to guess the plot of the next movie that we are watching on Cooler Than Homework. Next time, we will be discussing Horse Sense.
I look at this, I'm so tired. And I just think, it has to be about a horse girl. It has to be about a girl who's dreamed of having a horse her entire life. And then this horse, her name is Annabella. And she goes to
the horse or the girl?
A farm. The girl. The horse's name is Excalibur.
And she
sees all the other horses and goes to the stables. And much like you are peering out over a new cafeteria, she sees all these loving horses with their loving owners. And then Excalibur is like an asshole at the back who's like rowdy, mean, kicks dirt at her. But then she has a telepathic connection to the horse. And really, he's just mean because he got captured from the wild and he misses his family. And I was not a horse girl, so I'm not channeling real human emotion into this. So she really loves Excalibur and he misses his family. And so then she like rides away with him into the woods and then finds some other horses. And then her parents are like, oh, no, she's gone. And she's like, oh, I must save my horse. And then she really learns to trust her horse. And then they win a horse jumping competition or whatever they do. What is the tagline?
The tagline for this movie is, can this city guy and his cowboy cousin saddle up to save the ranch?
Oh, no. It's not a horse girl movie at all. Well, okay, obviously, it's about a city boy. He's probably 13. He comes to a ranch. He has a cousin who's probably like 14 or whatever, this older cousin. Noble, knows horses, cleans up chicken poop. And then the city boy is like, I don't care about farms. And then the cowboy cousin's like, my dad died and left the farm. And now me and the horse need help. And then the city boy is like, okay, I guess I do learn that hard work pays off. Also, horses are rad. And so it's a horse boy movie instead of a horse girl movie. Because really, horse people can be of all genders. The end.
Beautiful.
That's going to be the lesson that I learn for next time. So thank you for gifting me with that. And you can join us next time to find out if that is in any way the plot to Horse Sense. If you are enjoying this podcast, we would greatly appreciate it if you would tell your friends or rate and review it. We would love to hear all of your thoughts about Don't Look Under the Bed. So there will be a post dedicated to this episode up at snarksquad.com/decom, or you can find us all on Twitter at Decom Squad. I am at Sweeney Says.
I am at Matthew Gatos.
You can find me at My Name is Marines.
And I'm at C.E. Riley.
This podcast is produced by the four of us, edited by me, transcribed by Mari, and our theme music is by Stefan Chin. We will be back again in 2 weeks with Horse Sense.